Now, my understanding is that we have the same counsel on this case and the subsequent case, but they've got different facts, but some related issues.
Yes, the issue as to the...
State your name. I cut you off there.
Sorry, Judge Callahan?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Brian Isaacson, and I'm the attorney for both Paul Norman and Tony Cadillac. And the substantive issues are the same in both cases, involving the treatment of the AMT NOL under Section 56D of the Internal Revenue Code. The Tony Cadillac case has the additional issue as to whether or not the IRC Section 83B election is valid. He also has the issue as to whether or not the claim of right applies. In that analysis, if the Section 83B election is valid, then the claim of right doctrine would not apply. However, if it is, it would apply. So with my time, what I'd like to do is take my full 10 minutes in Paul Norman. The arguments in Norman and Cadillac would be the same, and
we will import that into, then consider them to be crossovers.
Yes, please, so I don't have to repeat the same argument. And then what I'd like to do in Cadillac is the argument under Section 83B is short, is just take 5 minutes and then reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, proceed.
Yep,
Excuse me, do you want to consolidate both arguments then?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. I have no objection. We'll grant your consolidation then, because I note that the government is similarly represented in both cases. You don't have any objection, do you? All right. Thank you.
Okay. The reason that we're here is that the administrative interpretation does not reconcile with the language of the statute that was adopted by Congress. Unfortunately, the administrative position was also adopted by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in Merlot versus Commissioner.
And it may be unfortunate, but and we're not necessarily bound by the Fifth Circuit, but it is now the law in the Fifth Circuit, and what do we do with that?
Well, that's what I'd like to address. The IRS's position can be summarized in Merlot and the Merlot decision at Star 624, where Merlot, the court states that Merlot argues that Section 56D2A, one little I, creates an exception to the usual rule under 172D that capital losses are taken into account for NOL purposes only to the extent of capital gains. And then the court says, but Merlot misapplies the statute. The court says the starting point for the AMT NOL computation under 172C and D, which accounts for capital losses and limits them to capital gains, and then the court cites to 56D1. Then the court states that none of the modifications made in the second step, as directed by 56D2A, override the 172D limitations. Now, Mike, I
guess a question that I have is your argument dependent upon our determination that the statutes in issue, particularly I think 26 U.S.C. Section 56, are clear and command your interpretation? I guess stated in another way, if we find the statutes to be ambiguous, why should we not defer to the government's interpretation of the statutes?
Well, it's sort of actually the AMT has never been the model of clarity. But number one, it is incumbent upon the government, and or at least on the agency. And
but if it's not clear, isn't the government entitled to some deference in the interpretation? I mean, if you it would seem to me to prevail, you have to convince us that it is clear and unambiguous.
Well, I think that we can do that as to certain aspects of it. It's sort of like looking at Mars or Venus through a telescope. There are certain truths that we know about the planet and certain things that we know to be untrue. And I think in that interpretation, if we look at those things that we know to be true, then I think that the court has a reasonable basis to override the government's
position. What does that mean, things that are to be true? What's that mean?
Well, let me go into that. is the language that what the government's arguing is that none of the modifications made in the second step as directed toward 56D2A override the 172 limitations. Well, we know that the plain language of the statute directly contradicts that conclusion by the Court of the Appeals.
Tell me how it contradicts, please.
Okay. First, 56B4, which is entitled Alternative Tax Net Operating Loss Deduction, specifically overrides the 172 limitations.
Tell me where that is, please.
It's in the Internal Revenue Code.
Which section?
It's 56B4. And that section states that the alternative net operating loss deduction shall be allowed in lieu of the net operating loss deduction allowed under Section 172. So it directly overrides the 172T limitations, and it does so specifically. And actually, there are four places in the statute where it does so. And please let me know if I'm speaking too quickly or if I should slow down.
Well, I want to go back to 170. You said, repeat that, D4?
Yes. Let me give you the four statutes that override specifically.
Just get me to the right one. D4 is what you were talking about. 172D4?
I'm talking about 56B, as in Barry. The second one is 56D, as in dog, 1, cap B, 1 little I. The third is 56D, as in dog, 2, capital A, 1 little I.
I've got those.
Okay. And let's talk about that. First of all, 56B4, it specifically states that the alternative tax net operating loss deduction shall be allowed in lieu of the net operating loss deduction under 172. So it shows that Congress specifically intended to override the 172 limitations as to the alternative minimum tax. Second, 56D, 1B, 1 little I, provides that in determining the amount of such deduction, the net operating loss within the meaning of Section 172C for any loss year shall be adjusted as provided in paragraph 2. And so what that means is that you start at the starting point, the net operating loss under 172C, and let's say that's $3,000. Then after that point, you make the adjustments. And so you've already taken the 172 limitations at the first sequence in the statute. But at the second sequence of the statute, there are no 172 limitations. Third, the third section of the statute, Section 56D, 2, cap A, provides that in the case of a loss year beginning after December 31st, 1986, the net operating loss for such year under Section 172C shall, 1, be determined with the adjustments provided in this Section 56. And alternative minimum tax adjustments relating to ISOs are adjustment items under 56D2A, 1 little I, because incentive stock options are an adjustment item under 56B3. And the statute states that 56D2A, 1 little I, applies to all adjustments under Section 56. Now, the final thing that we know is that Congress intended to apply the adjustments to 56D2A, 1 little I, but not, I'm sorry, they intended to apply the adjustments to 56D2A, 2 little I, but not 1 little I. And the reason for that is we know from the flesh language at the end of 56D2A, it says that there is an additional adjustment based upon 172 for those adjustments under 56D2A2i, but there is no such adjustment under 56D2A1i. So we know that Congress had looked at the issue as to whether adjustment should be applied under 1i, and they said that they were not. And actually, it does make...
This is very technical, but and you're throwing things around. If we looked at D2A II, it references the fact that an item of tax preference, blah, blah, you were using that, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it references 72C. 72C sub 2A indicates the amount deductible on account of losses from sale as exchange of capital assets shall not exceed the amount includable on gain account gains from sales or exchange of capital losses. Now, how do you figure that in?
Well, that only applies to the adjustment under 2i, but it does not apply to the adjustment under 1i.
Okay, what are the adjustments under 1i?
Well,
specifically.
Okay, specifically, one of the reasons that we are here is that the Treasury has provided very little guidance as to the adjustment. Under 1i, they've not adopted any Treasury regulations, not any revenue rulings. The only interpretation that we have for the calculation under the 1i adjustment are in the instructions to the Form 6251, which the IRS has changed in 2001, even though the longstanding instructions were in place from 1988 to 2000. And so the IRS and the district court held that the instructions are not authoritative, but as a practical matter, they are how the statute was applied.
Well, what do they say?
But what they say is that the original instructions state that the taxpayer is required to enter on line 9 of the Form 6251 the difference between the gain or loss, if any, reported on the regular tax and that figured for the AMT as a negative amount. Now listen to this. The difference as the negative amount is, one, if the AMT gain is less than the regular tax gain. Two, the AMT loss is more than the regular tax loss. It says to enter the full difference. If this were not the case under the agency's interpretation, what they're arguing is that when there's both an AMT loss and a regular tax loss, you enter zero because the AMT loss is limited under 172 to $3,000. The AMT loss, they argue, is limited to $3,000 under 172, which provides you with a zero adjustment. But this is not what their own instructions say. Their own instructions.
I guess you have two different, you know, you have paper losses, and then some people have actual losses. And obviously the government's arguing that those are treated differently. Can you explain to me conceptually what policies would be furthered by not limiting the AMT NOLs to the limits for regular tax NOLs?
I can, Your Honor. First thing is, under this limitation, under the statute, there was actually a trade-off for allowing the full deduction, and that departure is under 56D1A, where the increased loss is subject to a 10% additional haircut after the loss computation. And so the trade-off was that Congress allowed the full losses in full, but yet at the end of the statute they require a 10% haircut. The other part policy is it's the avoidance of double taxation, really. If one exercises their incentive stock options, they pay the tax on the difference between the fair market value and the exercise price, and they pay this at 28%. Now, if you don't have a negative adjustment in full, What you really have is a system of double taxation.
Well, now we're going into policy and politics. See, this is what's troubling me. We have a statute, and Judge Callahan walked you right down. If the statute's clear, we apply the statute. What the policy is, tax laws have never been fair or reasonable. They're just tax laws, and you just apply them. Now, if we're trying to change it because you haven't got the money to pay the tax, or if it's unfair because you had to pay 28% when you don't have the money, that's not the issue here. I know you went through the tax form and you tried to match it against the statute. That doesn't get me anywhere, and I think the government will straighten us out on it. I'm still trying to figure out how you, as an ordinary, you were not in business of trading stocks, right?
Right.
Okay, so how are you going to get a net operating loss?
Well, but let me go back to your first questions as to the instructions, is that the adjustment does not call for a net operating loss deduction. It calls for a reversal of the difference between the AMT gain and the regular tax gain. So if you have both and the shares are sold as a profit, the instructions say that you get a full reversal of the amount. And so the computation is predicated upon the full recovery of basis, not what
well,
the losses
you're
are.
You're giving terms here that I'd have to sit down. If you want to walk through the form, we can walk through the form. But you're assuming that you fit in one of those designations on the form. Can you, as an individual, your client, have a net operating loss deduction? He's not in the business of trading stocks. He just happened to get a stock option as part of as an incentive to his salary.
Yes, and the reason is that Congress changed the definition of the net operating loss deduction for the alternative minimum tax when they enacted Section 56.
Well, I don't know what that means. Can you still get a deduction for net operating loss?
Yes.
How do you do that?
You do it under the rules, under the sequence of the statute.
No, but why do you get? Why aren't you limited by the fact that you're an individual, and a net operating loss relates to what? To an individual or to a business?
The net operating loss relates to a business, and the reason that you can get that is because Congress specifically excluded the 172C limitations in Section 1 little I of the statute.
My guess is the government will dispute that, but we'll hear from them. So you're relying on that provision then, the 172C exclusion?
We're relying upon the plain language of the statute.
If you lose the 172 argument, where do you go?
If we lose the 172, the 172 argument is the basis of our claim.
That's what I, going through all your readings, that's what I came to, the same conclusion.
Yes, and it's purely a statutory construction argument, because executive agencies, including the IRS, are not permitted to legislate by adding terms or requirements to the statute that simply are not there.
You've used 17 and a half minutes. Do you want to reserve the balance for rebuttal?
17 and a half?
Yep. You went through 10, and now you've used 7.
Oh, yeah.
You've used almost 8 more. So do you want to reserve the balance for rebuttal?
Yes, please. And then what about Cadillac?
Well, you said you wanted to consolidate them, and you were going to use 10 and 5.
Okay.
And we're, so essentially, why don't you sit down and you reserve the balance for rebuttal on both, but if we have more questions, we'll give you more time.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So essentially, you're using your 20 for both cases right now.
Okay.
Okay.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Francesca Tamami, counsel for the government in the Norman case, counsel for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue in the Cadillac case. I just wanted to turn directly to the taxpayer's argument that Section 56, if the AMT provisions, overrides the limitations in Section 172, which defines net operating loss for regular tax purposes. And that is not correct. If you look at the plain language of Section 56D1, and this is on
page... Is that D as in B or dog?
D as in dog.
Okay.
This is page 28 of the government's Norman brief. It's in the statutory appendix. This defines the alternative tax net operating loss deduction. And D1 says, for purposes of subsection A4, the term alternative tax net operating loss deduction means the net operating loss deduction allowable for the tax year under Section 172. So the starting point for calculating the AMT NOL is Section 172, which, as Judge Brunetti pointed out, limits the capital loss deduction for an individual. Then the remainder of this Section 56D provides that certain adjustments be made based on these AMT preferences, adjustments in Section 56, 57, and 58. None of those adjustments change the regular rules limiting capital losses. That's the short response to the taxpayer's argument here. And
is that clear, or is it ambiguous and we defer to your interpretation?
It's complicated and technical, but once you make your way through all the code provisions, we think the result is clear under the plain language of the statute, and that this court does not need to defer to an agency interpretation to reach that result. The mechanical provisions of the Internal Revenue Code do not allow the taxpayers here to claim the AMT net operating loss in the way that they've said they can, and there's no need to defer to the IRS's litigating position or any kind of IRS notice to reach that result.
Where does this 172 argument fall apart?
172C and D, 2 and 4, which is, let's see, just a couple more pages in our statutory appendix.
Yes.
Page 30.
Yes.
The net operating loss is defined in Section 172C. That provision then says, look at the modifications in subsection D as in dog. D2 says, there are two different provisions that limit it. D2 says capital gains and losses of taxpayers other than corporations. This basically says that if you're not a corporation, you can only offset capital losses to the extent of capital gains.
That's the section I read to him, the D2A, right?
Correct. D2A, and then also a relevant provision here, because neither taxpayer was involved in the business of trading stocks, is D4, which limits non-business deductions of taxpayers other than corporations.
Now, the Merlo decision isn't binding on us, but I think you both were arguing on that case as well. Do you think the Merlo court got it right?
We do. The Merlo case, the facts are somewhat different, but not in any way that matters. The operative facts are the same in that case as in this case. The taxpayer exercised incentive stock options in 2000. The fair market value of the stock at that time was very high. It subjected him to the AMT. He took a substantial hit in terms of AMT income in that year. The following year, in 2001, his stock became worthless. Under the Internal Revenue Code, that's treated as a sale or exchange of the capital asset at that time. He incurred a substantial AMT capital loss that he couldn't do anything with, because in 2001, Merlo did not have any alternative minimum taxable income that he could use to absorb the capital loss. And he basically made this same argument here, that, well, the capital loss actually gives rise to a net operating loss, and I can use that. I can carry it back to 2000 to offset that income that I had to realize in that year. And that is basically the same argument that both Norman and Cadillac are making here.
Can a regular taxpayer ever carry a net operating loss? You can't carry it backward. That's for a corporation, right?
The net operating loss, if you're looking just in the regular income tax context, for individuals, they can have a net operating loss on the basis of other kinds of losses, not capital losses.
I'm talking about capital losses. Stay with the capital losses.
Yeah, just on capital losses, no. An individual can never actually carry back a capital loss. An individual can use, in one tax year, they can use their capital losses to offset capital gains.
Up to $3,000.
And then, right, up to $3,000.
That's the other limitation.
Right.
The basic rule under 72 whatever C is no capital losses over capital gains.
Right.
But then there's another section that allows you to go up to $3,000, and that's...
Correct. That is Section 1211.
1211, right.
B as in boy of the Internal Revenue Code.
And that's just for regular taxpayers. Now, and I don't know that counsel is trying to argue that he should fit into the business category. I'm not sure what his argument is there, but I don't think he is.
To my understanding of these cases, they've never raised that argument.
Well, because he was arguing about
items on the form, but you can't get to an item on the form until you define yourself into the item that's on the form, isn't it?
That's correct. I think, and this argument wasn't specifically raised in this case, in these cases, as far as I'm aware, but I know it's been raised in other similar cases involving AMT net operating losses. The argument was that the form, I think it was 6251, that individuals used to use, or they still use it, the form has since been modified, but that the form was unclear and that taxpayers going through the form may have been misled into thinking that they could convert an AMT capital loss into an AMT net operating loss. Now, the government submits that that was not the result under this form, but in an abundance of caution, the IRS issued modified instructions clarifying that you're not allowed to do that on the form. One thing I would point out in both of these cases, in Norman and Cadillac, the taxpayers originally filed their own returns, and the government submits correctly. Neither Norman or Cadillac claimed AMT net operating losses on that form. They subsequently filed amended returns after conferring with counsel, and they then came up with this argument. So this is not a situation where either taxpayer was misled by this form, improperly reported their tax, thought that, great, I've got a net operating loss, and then got a nasty letter in the mail later saying, well, our form was unclear. I'm sorry you couldn't avail yourself of this.
So that argument, we can take the form argument and put it off to the side.
Correct. And that form argument has been, I don't think either court addressed it in these cases because I don't think it was raised below, but other courts have considered and rejected it, particularly I think the Guzak case in the Court of Federal Claims, which we cited in our brief, and I think also the Lund case, which was in the Court of Federal Claims, and that was also recently affirmed by the Federal Circuit. We sent a 28-J letter last week that I hope the court received.
Seems as though there was two cases you cited in the 28-J. There was only one case.
There were two cases, actually. Merlo was one. We sent a 28-J about that a while back. That was the first Fifth Circuit case. There's a second Fifth Circuit case in Re Pavlovsky that was also affirmed by the Fifth Circuit. It was an unpublished opinion, but basically the Fifth Circuit said this case appears to be bound by our decision in Merlo. And so they affirmed in that case. And then the third case is the Lund case, which was Court of Federal Claims and affirmed without opinion by the Federal Circuit in April. Unless the court has any further questions regarding the AMT NOL argument, I did want to just turn and address the Section 83B argument in the Cadillac case.
Please.
Go ahead. Basically, in the Cadillac case, the taxpayer received both vested and non-vested shares of stock when he exercised his option. Under Section 83, he did not have to include the non-vested shares in income because they were subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture. However, he made an election to do so under Section 83B. As the tax court explained in that case, this election is basically a gamble. If you think the stock will appreciate by the time it vests, by the time you would have to include it in income, then you would elect to include it in income now when the value is substantially lower. In this case, that's what the taxpayer did, but he predicted wrong. It turned out the stock significantly was devalued by the time it vested, and he's trying to get out of his election by arguing that the stock was never transferred to him.
Now, that's cut off by 83B1B, is that right?
That 83B1B would be, sorry, let me just grab my other.
I think that's the one we're talking about here. If the election is made, Section A shall not apply with respect to the transfer of such property and such property subsequently forfeited. No deduction shall be allowed in respect to such forfeiture. Is that the one?
Right. Well, what the taxpayer is arguing in this case is that if you look actually at Section 83B1, it says any person who performs services in connection with which property is transferred to any person, and that's where basically their argument is, wait a minute, the property was never transferred to us. I didn't even have the power to make a Section 83B election, so I didn't need to include the stock in income in 2000.
Yeah, but he's relying on that Treasury reg, which he conveniently leaves off to the end of the Treasury reg, that the transfer to set aside claims of creditors from the transfer. He says that it was the Treasury reg says the term of property also includes beneficial interest in assets, including money which are transferred or set aside from claims of creditors of transfer. He said this wasn't so, except that he left off the words, for example, in a trust or escrow account, and this was an escrow account.
That's correct. In this case, the non-vested shares were placed in an escrow account. The taxpayer had voting rights with respect to the non-vested shares, and dividends earned on the non-vested shares were paid directly to him.
And he had unvested shares, which he didn't have to make the election to. The vested shares were covered anyway.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Basically, Section 83B was meant precisely to cover a situation where a taxpayer receives non-vested stock. And the idea is give the taxpayer the election to take it into income now when he thinks the value is lower. The taxpayer here is essentially pointing to the fact that it's non-vested as a reason for invalidating his election, in which case the section would never apply. That's really all I have to say about the Section 83B election, unless the court has further questions.
And then, of course, in Cadillac, you'd are just to follow again, like Norman, and like the Fifth Circuit in Merlot.
Correct.
Is there anything different in Cadillac that would make as far as his options that would make any difference in the analysis?
Not in the government's view. One thing, actually, I wanted to point out back to Norman is just the one difference, I guess, between Cadillac and Norman is that in the Norman case, the taxpayer is actually not trying to carry back the net operating loss. He's arguing that he has a net operating loss that actually offsets his regular income in the same tax year. There's absolutely no basis in the code or treasury regulations for using an AMT NOL, even if it existed, to offset regular income. In the Cadillac case, he actually is trying to carry it back. There's no basis for doing that either, but that's really the only sort of difference on the facts between these two cases as far as the AMT NOL argument goes.
Would you repeat that first part, because I think it's important. There's no provision in the code to take an AMT NOL and offset it against regular income.
Correct.
Yeah. And in this case, that would be Norman.
That would be the Norman case.
Because he did not try to offset it against his capital gain.
Right. He attempted to use this AMT capital loss to offset the ordinary regular taxable income that he reported in the same tax year. He ended up owing, I think, $11,000 in tax and is seeking a refund of that amount. Unless the court has further questions, the government would just ask that both decisions be affirmed.
Well, in terms of just if... You know, not speaking for the court or whatever, but speaking on the issue of publication, obviously this circuit, you know, Merlot does not control this circuit, so, but you're saying that you agree with that reasoning, and generally speaking, the court, if the court were to publish, would not publish both cases, would publish on one, and then be the other case would be disposed of. In terms of legal issues, do you see either from the government's perspective?
I think from the government's perspective, it would be important to have a published opinion from this court on the AMT NOL issue, particularly because there are actually three other cases pending that are stayed pending the decision in Norman. There's the Hernandez, the Montgomery, and the Spitz case that were cited in our brief, stayed pending the decision in Norman. Now, Norman just focuses on AMT NOL. At the same time, we believe that it would be important to have a published decision on the Section 83B issue that's presented just in the Cadillac case and not in the Norman case. But as far as the AMT NOL issue goes, it's really identical in the two cases.
So, I mean, from your perspective, then it would make sense to publish in Cadillac. And on more issues.
I guess so. I hope my supervisors would not disagree with me. I think so.
We're not asking your supervisors anyway, and we'll make that decision ourselves anyway. I'm thinking through all of the issues. All right, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
He actually has 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Right.
Okay. Thank you. We are asking the court to publish a decision, and we're also asking the court to rule on what is the correct number in terms of the AMT amount. And you have to go to the instructions, and this is what the whole problem is the IRS has...
Was that argued below at any point?
Pardon?
The instruction issue. According to counsel, the instruction issue never came up below.
Well, it was in the lower court in Norman. In fact, it was in the published decision. And the problem is that the Treasury has not issued any guidance. And there's no place else to go in terms of determining what that number is.
So you're saying that the instructions trump the statute?
We're saying that you have to look at both simultaneously.
Well, instructions have words of art in them, like alternative minimum tax, NOL. And whether you have one or you don't is a decision before you go to the instructions. So I understand what you're saying about the instructions, but you still got to qualify in the instructions to be one of those classifications. You're just saying that you do, that's all.
Right. We're saying that the statute precedes the instructions, but you have to look at both. The other part is on the...
If you don't fit the statute, you're never going to get in the instruction. Let's put it that way. If you don't fit the statute's definition, you're never going to put yourself into an instruction on that definition.
But we do fit it because there are no 172C limitations in one little I.
I got you.
Now, let's go on to the 83B argument. I think I've got 2 minutes. The statute uses the language, which are set aside from the claims of creditors. And then they use...
You forgot to put the rest of that regulation in your brief.
Okay, and then they say, for example, a trust or an escrow account.
And this was an escrow account.
This was an escrow account, but in our briefing, they were still subject to the claims of creditors. And just let me... we brief on our opening brief on page 27. We have several decisions by the bankruptcy court holding that those shares under these provisions are still subject to claims of creditors.
You're talking about the rabbi trust?
Yes. Yeah, okay. Yes. So you've got to do both. You can put them into an escrow, but the language in that escrow agreement has to say that they're not subject to the claims of creditors.
Is there any evidence in this case that in particular this particular trust was subjected to the claims of creditors?
Yes, there is. First of all, the corporation unilaterally had the right to repurchase the shares at cost. We have no transfer to the individual. The beneficial ownership rules were intended to apply where there is a transfer or where there is a transfer set aside from the claims of creditors. On page 27 of our brief, we cite several cases holding that this type of a transfer is not sufficient to protect the asset against the claims of creditors of the corporation. And I think I'm down to 22 seconds. The other thing I'd like to say is on the AMT case, we're not claiming a capital loss. We're claiming an AMT loss under Section 172. We're not claiming to offset that loss against regular income. We're claiming to offset that only against the alternative minimum taxable income.
All right. And do you have any further questions?
No.
All right. Having no further questions, both the Norman versus the United States of America and Cadillac versus the Commissioner of the IRS are now submitted as of this date. Thank you both for your argument. The last matter on calendar for argument today is Truck Stop versus Sprint Corporation 0735123.